company for uniforms, including shoes, textbooks, calculators, dictionaries, pens, pencils, and more. For poor rural families earning the equivalent of
citizen-driven internet policy. Open Media believes in keeping the internet uncensored, open, innovative, secure, and providing universal access to fast and affordable networks. If you would like Open Media to keep campaigning for citizens and internet policy, you can donate to them at openmedia.org or openmedia.ca. You can also find them on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Google+.
High school is not free in Kenya, East Africa. As well as tuition fees, families must find money for uniforms, including shoes, textbooks, calculators, dictionaries, pens, pencils, and more. For poor rural families earning the equivalent of $2 to $3 a day, this is often an impossible challenge. Will you help educate bright, very poor Kenyan youth to help them find a road out of poverty for their families? Just $50 a month will allow that to happen. Gifts of smaller amounts can be combined to give youth a chance through KEEF, the Kenya Education Endowment Fund, a registered, BC-based, volunteer-run educational charity. Tax-deductible receipts are available. Donations make great gifts for Christmas, graduation, anniversaries, promotions, etc. Gift cards are available. More information at www.kenyaeducation.org or you can call us at 604-415-9397, day or evening.
Thank you. What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm your host, Spencer Latu, and for today's show, we are speaking truth to power about the war on drugs that Canada has signed on to continue, that they've always been a part of, and the USMCA. Not to be confused with the YMCA, and it's really not fun to stay in this trade agreement. Okay, so to begin the show, I'm going to try to end the tokenistic, almost like paternalizing land acknowledgments that kind of just everyone gets a little bit uncomfortable hearing because they seem kind of silly and pointless. And I will heed that in the sense that the way that most people do them and the way they're kind of seen, especially around UBC, a shining example of colonialism and how just absurd it seems that whenever somebody brings up a territory or land acknowledgement. So I would like to begin by acknowledging that the land on which we gather or listen to this program, or where this program is recorded, is the unceded territory of the Coast Salish peoples, including territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. So, that is the land, the stolen land on which we are doing this show, where I study, and where I call home. So, I'm conflicted, as I'm complicit in the colonial mission that the people who landed here many hundreds of years ago undertook. So I would like to start this off with just acknowledging that I'm complicit, but in that does not mean that I inherently am necessarily a bad person or anything along those lines. What it means is that I am reflecting on my place in colonialism and capitalism and all the dangerous, horrible ideas that have cost many, many, many thousands, millions of lives so far. So I'd like to begin with my complicity, but also what that means by me being complicit. I unfortunately hike up the prices of the renter market, as I'm just yet another student who's trying to live in UBC related areas, and that only enriches the speculators who are profiteering off of the housing market. They're hoping that in this election of the Vancouver Civic election that they can get one of their corporate shill buddies like Hector Bremner in there to jack up the supply, and that'll solve all our problems, because that was the problem to begin with. No, the problem is that you can make money from selling homes, something that every human being needs, and where we have a society based on the buying and selling of homes as commodities rather than treating them what they are, which is necessary parts of survival. So for whatever reason, the First Nations people, the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh Nations, they understood how important a shelter was, and that's why in their societies there was no homeless people, because everybody in those indigenous societies had a role to play. I'm not saying all the roles were perfect, and I'm not saying that they had the same level of nuance or even the same maybe the same respect for what people are capable of as we think of them today. But at the end of the day, everyone had shelter, and that's something that we as a society, that if we're so advanced and we're so far into the future and we're the technocratic saviors of the planet, we should probably get everyone into a home. And the fact that we can't spells trouble for our system. So I would, that little diatribe, I apologize for, but at the same time, we also need to be a little bit more thoughtful when it comes to land acknowledgements. I know I say unceded Musqueam territory every episode, every commercial break, but it's always important to reflect on what that means and where I personally intersect into it, and as well as some of the issues that go on with colonialism. So thank you for reflecting with me on that, and we will get right into the news. So some straight talk in the Georgia Strait from friend of the show, Travis Lupik. He posted this September 26th. This is in regards to Trudeau and his signing on to Donald Trump's global war on drugs that he brought up at the United Nations. So the headline is, Trudeau reaffirms Canada's support for the war on drugs, ignoring concerns it will lead to more overdose deaths. While Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal begin discussions on decriminalization, Canada's Liberal government again insists it is not going to happen. The article reads, this week earned condemnation from health experts and advocates for drug policy reform when it signed onto a new renewed commitment to the United States war on drugs. We should be extremely disappointed, frustrated, and angry that prohibition policies that literally kill thousands of Canadians each year and actually promotes drug use is supported by our leaders. Those were the words of Dr. Mark Tyndall, Executive Director of the BC Centre for Disease Control. That was in a tweet he tweeted on September 25th in reference to Canada signs on to U.S.-led renewal of war on drugs. Article goes on. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau reaffirmed Canada's participation in America's drug war at the United Nations General Assembly on Monday, September 24th. He made Canada one of 130 nations to support U.S. President Donald Trump's global call to action on the world drug problem. The document restates America's commitment to combating drug use with law enforcement and an international drug control system to adequately respond to dangerous emerging synthetic drugs. So we already did have an episode on the opioid crisis, but we haven't really talked too much about the war on drugs. So historically, the war on drugs began with Richard Nixon in 1971 when he declared that drug abuse was public enemy number one and they needed to eradicate it. And to eradicate it, rather than maybe dealing with the reasons of why people use drugs, which is a multitude of reasons that should be explored, and we need far more than an hour episode of the Spencer Lattu Show to consider all those issues. But the fact is of the matter is the strategy they used was law enforcement. So unfortunately, and I know this might come as a surprise to people, but law enforcement is completely useless when it comes to dealing with drugs. And the reason I say that is not because they're not good at arresting people. Oh, they're fantastic at arresting people. They lock up so many people that the United States has become the world's largest penal colony on Earth. They house the most prisoners, period, and the most prisoners per capita. The stats are incredible, and as much as I'd love to get into how horrible the war on drugs has been, I will just leave it there, and that can be your own research where you can look up what the prison statistics are. So the United States has been committed to locking people up for drugs. Now, what has that meant? Well, as you can tell from the opioid crisis that we are currently in, that we were talking about a couple weeks ago, that strategy has not worked in the slightest. In fact, it turns out that there's people who are not criminals, gasp, not criminals, that are selling drugs to people, that kill people and get them hooked on to opioids, and then they end up moving to heroin, and then they get one bad batch of heroin mixed with fentanyl, and then they're dead. So we saw this in Purdue Pharma and their lies about OxyContin and how OxyContin was apparently the safe version of heroin, which it was not, and it was just as addictive as anything else. And from there, what happened was that everybody got hooked on these drugs that were being freely given out by doctors, and then that is basically when the opioid crisis came to a head, was when the drugs were so prevalent that everyone was hooked on them, and then they tried to pull away the supply, and thinking that if people couldn't just get their hands on drugs, they go cold turkey and quit, which they didn't, and they just moved to heroin, and then people started dying like crazy. And it's disgusting and sad because it's completely preventable, because as I just stated, you can see how if maybe Purdue Pharma and those other pharmaceutical companies and doctors and the pill mills that were being operated weren't just pushing drugs onto people. The statistic for West Virginia and Michigan were crazy. It was like, I think it was 30 or more pills per person, man, like from ages, like from newborns to like the elderly, like every, like if you divided the amount of pills in Michigan and West Virginia, it was about 30 or more per person. So that's how prevalent opioid and we're talking like pharmaceutical grade prescription opioids, not even heroin, just the complete legal trade. So that's how prevalent these things are. And then obviously locking people up hasn't worked. So what does the Liberal government do last week? Well, they just double down on it. Why did they double down on it? Well, a lot of people, myself included, saw this as a complete political ploy, just because the upcoming NAFTA talks were coming in the next week, which we will get to later in this episode. But from that, it's clear that Justin Trudeau and the Liberal Party, they made their calculations and they figured that, okay, well, I guess that if we want to have the best version of NAFTA we can get, which they didn't get, and we'll get back to that later, but they figured that they could get the most for their side if they signed on to whatever Trump was saying earlier, thinking it would buy him points. So we'll get into whether or not that played out as maybe they intended. I don't even know if they intended to do that, or if they're just cynical, and just because the Liberals already have adopted an anti-decriminalization posture, so, or maybe just a criminalization posture to avoid the double negative there. So the Liberal government has stated multiple times that they are not in favor of decriminalization. They are instead committed to continuing criminalization of drugs, knowing that it is not doing anything, and there are people such as NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson, the BC health official Mark Tyndall, that I just read his tweet about condemning the Trudeau government's approach, as well as many other health officials across and policymakers across Canada. So they're all on board. They see the writing on the wall. They don't want to see any more Canadians die needlessly because of some silly posturing that the ideologues down south really need to get through, you know, really need to show everybody how tough on crime they are, and like how that's going to solve the problem, which I will admit that the whole tough on crime and locking people up for drugs, that's all just dog whistling to white supremacists who, and thinking that, oh, well, if we're tough on crime, we're going to lock up more black people, and locking up more black people solve the problem, which it obviously won't, but you can see how it garners some support. Anyways, the Trudeau and the Liberal government, here's what they had to say. In regards to decriminalization, they said, "We are not looking at decriminalizing or legalizing any other drugs aside from cannabis, as decriminalizing would not ensure quality control of drugs, and there would still be risk of contamination on the streets." So that was the health minister, Jeanette Petipas Taylor, stating the Liberals' point of view on that. So obviously from that statement, you can see how they kind of dodge the fact of, well, criminals, they don't talk about the death toll that the war on drugs has, and just the commitment to mass incarceration and terrorizing people by locking them up for minor nonviolent drug offenses. They instead focus on talking about how they cannot ensure the quality of drugs, which is arguably not true, because if you had pharmaceutical grade heroin, I don't know how fentanyl would get into that supply. It's not like people are overdosing on the legal heroin they're getting. It's the illegal heroin they're getting. And they state how there's risk of contamination on the streets. Well, duh. I mean, like, of course it can be contaminated on the streets. The idea is that we take people off the frickin' streets, Mr. Taylor. Come on. Like, think for a second, dude. We want these people out of the streets, out of the alleyways of downtown Eastside Vancouver, and we want to put them into places like Insight or hospitals or anywhere else where they can get the things that they need. If you're a diabetic and you needed insulin, I wouldn't say, oh, well, I don't want to give everyone insulin because I'm afraid it could get contaminated on the streets. Like, you just laugh at me for saying something so stupid, but like, you're allowed to say that about drugs because drugs are bad and drugs are the enemy. And it's not that, I don't know, the conditions of industrial capitalism basically turning people into cogs and machines isn't what drives people to do drugs and get synthetic highs rather than getting highs on life. But hey, that's just my ideas, but whatever. So what we can tell from Justin Trudeau and the Liberals is that they are basically signing the death warrant of even more Canadians. So keep that in mind. You know, I was part of the strategic voting campaign. I agreed. I mean, in my riding, personally, in Richmond, it was hard conservative, so it wasn't looking too good for us. But I completely understand why we wanted to get rid of Stephen Harper, because Stephen Harper sucked even more than Justin Trudeau. He was hard on drugs. He tried to get rid of Insight when he was in power. So I'm not saying that it was a failed strategy, but nonetheless, the lesser of two evils is still evil, and people will still die, and there will still be violence exacted upon the most marginalized people, which are people on the streets doing drugs. So so let's talk about the numbers now. So this is another great article by a friend of the show, Travis Lupik. He posted this one today, October 1st. Oh, yes, listeners, I should note that we were recording this October 1st because your host, your boy, will be enjoying the sweet songs of Jay-Z and Beyonce at the On the Run tour show. So that is why we are doing this a day early, but hopefully this is still on everyone's minds tomorrow. So getting to the straight talk here from the Georgia Strait, the headline reads, coroner's analysis shows average victim of BC's opioid epidemic is male, using drugs alone and often in pain. A separate report released the same week states that during the first 8 months of 2018, there's an average of 122 deaths per month in British Columbia, compared to an average of 23 deaths per 5 month per month 5 years earlier. So in 5 years, you see how we've added almost 100 more bodies per month. People dying needlessly. And I say needlessly again, because why are people dying? Well, it's because they can't get their drugs legally. They can't do the thing that they're going to do anyway, because they're addicted to heroin. They can't do that in a safe place with medical staff around them, with anybody around them to help them from either overdosing, but also to help them get through their addictions or do anything for them. So we're just relegated these people to the streets. We've put them in boxes. Basically, we're leaving them alone, and that is why people are dying. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that, oh, do heroin, heroin's good for you. No, all I'm saying, and what Travis is saying, what all of us who care and are concerned about harm reduction, is that we want to see the least amount of pain inflicted upon human beings who are in a worse position than we are. I don't want to see anybody die over this. No matter what they did, I don't want them to die. Doing drugs should not be a death sentence. Anyways, the article reads, the BC Coroner's Service's latest monthly report on the province's drug overdose crisis once again suggests there is no end in sight. The report, which covers up to the end of August 2018, states that there were 98 fatal overdoses in BC that month. It brings the total for the year to 972, which equates to a projected 1,458 deaths for all of 2018. That compares to 1,452 in 2017 and 993 in 2016. In 2018, the rate of fatal overdoses for the city of Vancouver stands at 56.1 per 100,000 people, an astronomical figure that is now nearly 10 times what the rate of overdoses was for Vancouver 10 years earlier. There was only 6.1 per 100,000 people dying in 2008. Those are just shocking numbers. And that is the death toll that we're seeing from policies that Justin Trudeau is signing on to. Those are the numbers that you can accredit to the Liberal government. Those are the numbers you can ascribe to anybody that's pushing the war on drugs. Don't get me wrong. The Liberals aren't the only ones pushing that. The Conservatives absolutely are. They're the most heartless, gutless people on earth. This is not me running interference for them. And I never want this show to ever feel like, just because I'm attacking people who are quote unquote on the left, I don't want this to seem like I'm apologizing for the Conservatives. They're just as worse. But what we need in this society is to people to critique it from both sides, and we need to have an honest conversation about what's going on and what we can do to fix it. So clearly the Liberals are complicit in this, and they're the people in power, so I feel like it's my job to call them out for what they're doing, which is adding more bodies into the already horrifically high body count. We'll be back in just one moment. There will be a couple commercials, and we'll be right back to chat more about the opioid crisis and how the war on drugs is only exacerbating that. So we'll be back in just 1 second.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Allow me to tell you about Unceded Airways.
What's that?
Isn't that some kind of indigenous radio show?
It sure is. Tell me, are you down for decolonization? Yeah. What?
I certainly wish I could hear about indigenous issues, people, and events on the radio.
You're in luck, because Unceded Airwaves talks about all these things and more every Monday morning at 11.
Music from indigenous artists and coverage of all the hot happenings in indigenous art and entertainment.
On CITR 101.9 FM.
Oh, wow. And they broadcast all this from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people?
Find out for yourself. Monday mornings at 11. Yeah. Or find episodes online at CITR.ca.
Today we're joined in the studio by the Cedar Program Youth.
Where you are at.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm your host, Spencer Latu, and we just finished discussing friend of the show, Travis Lupik's coverage of the Trudeau Liberal government going along with Donald Trump and his horrible, disgusting, deadly war on drugs that does not do anything to curb substance abuse, doesn't do anything to help people on hooked on substances, as does very little to help even law enforcement, because it puts them in the way of danger, I guess, dealing with more things that aren't donut related. But basically, it's bad for everybody except for the ruling class that loves to exercise its power to punish those who are already on the margins of society. So a prevailing theory of why the Trudeau government went along with the war on drugs, which was horrible for humanity, is that they wanted to score some points in the political NAFTA debate. So while I will say that I could also see a countervailing theory, which is that the Trudeau Liberal government doesn't really care about people and doesn't really care that people are going to die from their policies or the policies that they tacitly support, which I think is pretty reasonable considering that they do have a posturing of keeping drugs except for cannabis criminalized. I could just see it just being that, but if they're going to, I don't know what's better or worse, if it's that they're, you know, throwing marginalized Canadians, adding more bodies to the 1,400 or so people who are projected to die, an extra 500 or so overdose deaths in BC this year, if they're going to use those as pawns in their game to score a better trade deal, which doesn't really do much for anybody, which is in fact hurt our country and hurt the workers of Canada and Mexico and the United States, as I will get into once we dive into the NAFTA talks and the new agreement that they've reached called the USMCA, the United States Mexico Canada agreement, which apparently Donald Trump wanted to call it the USMC because it would be the acronym for United States Marine Corps. Just shows you how much of a bootlicker he is. He's still getting a hard-on for the Marines and pretending how great they are. And instead, it sounds more like the United States version of the YMCA. So it's really not fun to stay there. It's not nearly as great as the song is. So we're going to discuss for a hot minute here, what is NAFTA? And I have some strong opinions on NAFTA. I think in general it was a lie thrust upon society, and just as well as globalization and all these kind of international trade deals. In my opinion, they were lies sold to the world by smiling faces like Bill Clinton's. He's a liar, and he's not like Donald Trump, though, because although Bill Clinton afterwards has kind of backed away from how great NAFTA is, as opposed to Donald Trump's big lie, where he will say that things that have happened did not happen. So there's kind of a distinction there, I want to say. There's lie one, which is kind of like the okay political lies of NAFTA, saying that's going to help workers, when in reality all it did was help massive multinational corporations. And then there's the bad lies, lie two, which is when you lie about things that are objectively true, and you are running a propaganda game. So to go from there, we're going to discuss what is NAFTA. So what is NAFTA? NAFTA is the North American Free Trade Agreement, and it went into effect January 1st, 1994, amongst the United States, Mexico, and Canada. So the way it came to be was very shady from the get-go. It was passed basically behind closed doors in three quote-unquote democratic countries. The reason why it had to be super secretive, and it had to have... we needed the corporate media running constant stories about how great free trade is, because obviously free trade is great, guys, right? Free, that's great. Trade, that's great. What could go wrong? Okay, lots. And we're going to get into that. So why it's bad is because basically free trade removes the previous barriers and taxes that countries would place on companies that did not reside within their nation, because the idea was that they didn't want the workforce of America being undercut by cheaper industry. So historically, the United States post 1776, after they revolted against the British, they had extremely protectionist policies up until about World War I or so, because they knew that if they opened their markets to getting textiles, for example, from Britain, who had far bigger factories, they were able to produce it at a lower cost and the like, because they would have been crushed and they would have been subservient to British textile needs. They instead placed tariffs so high that it would not be advantageous to go after British textiles. You'd have to go with American anyways. So it was policies like that that allowed American economy to grow. And just same with Canada as well, just everybody in general, is that that allows the industries from within the borders to do well, as opposed to outside. So this isn't, and as well, I'd like to note that I'm not a nativist. I'm not saying buy Canadian, you know, we need to enrich Canada. I'm just trying to give a pretty fair shake of how it worked and like why NAFTA and why we are in the place that we are today. So the idea behind NAFTA and all free trade agreements, free trade was generally dominated by the British Empire historically, because as they were the hegemons of the world, they wanted people to open up their markets and drop their tariffs so that they could sell British goods in their markets, and that way the British companies could expand, because they had the greatest producing power. And if they could move their operations into other countries that didn't maybe have as high of a labor standard, that they could make even more money. So basically, that is why Mexico is involved in this, and Canada to some extent. But the idea was that in the 1990s, in reaction to, in my opinion, the 70s strength of the left and the strength of the trade unionists and the workers basically being organized, NAFTA was kind of the death blow to the unions, because what NAFTA allowed was U.S. offshoring of jobs to Mexico. So when Trump starts going on about moving all the jobs to Mexico, he's like a broken clock. He's right twice a day, and then he's not right in his conclusions, but in the premise that jobs were offshored in Mexico, he's correct. So what happened was those manufacturing jobs that the middle American high school educated white guy kind of job was was to work in manufacturing. So after, you know, you finished high school football and whatever classes they barely attended, they would move on and go into these manufacturing jobs, which required low levels of training outside of that. They didn't require formal education and all that jazz that we're forced to do today for our own detriment, as you can see with all the student loan crisis. Nonetheless, that was kind of the cornerstone of middle America. That's how people who really were unexceptional workers in the grand scheme of things made it, was they were able to get a job with minimal education, and they could just kind of be cogs in the machines of these massive corporations like GM and all these the manufacturers that build like appliances and stuff like that, all those American companies that were located in like Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, and the like. So what NAFTA did was basically destroy the Midwest and move all those jobs to Mexico, because in Mexico, the labor standards were far, far, far lower, way worse for the planet environmentally, standards and regulations compared to the United States. So the corporations, and this is why I'm an anti-capitalist, because if you look at the way that they drew it up, they're like, oh, well, you know, if we could just somehow move these jobs from here and then we can make way more money over there without doing anything other than undercutting our labor force. So as you can see there, like, capitalism and the big lie, in my opinion, that sold it was that, you know, the rising tide will lift all boats. But as you can see here, they're not really lifting any boats. Instead, in the 90s, they're like, well, you know, I could lift my boat up by pushing their boat down. And by them and us, I mean the capitalists, so the people that own these corporations, compared to the workers, who are the ones that, I don't know, created all the profit for the corporations up until this point, that they decided to screw them over. So shows you how much loyalty that these people have, hey? And now these people were forced with either A, accepting way, like, destroying their union and all the workers' labor rights that they earned through fighting against a corporation, although they were like highly uneducated and the like, they were still laborers and deserved a decent amount of pay and benefits and, you know, two cars and a white picket fence and all that jazz. And the corporations were like, nah, we're going to Mexico. And so they moved their factories to Mexico to make cars cheaper, to make appliances cheaper, and undercut their labor force and make people and leave people unemployed, leave people without a union to represent them, and leave people without any kind of purpose in the Midwest. So that's what NAFTA is to me. So some other things about NAFTA is that it allowed corporations to sue countries that either used quote-unquote unfair environmental regulations or labor regulations, or any like buy Canadian or buy American or buy Mexican kind of laws that they tried, or policies they tried to institute. So what that allowed was corporations to basically sue governments that are owned, that are supposed to be operated and, you know, filled with the citizenry and have people in charge, like having the government run by the people. Well, the corporations can now say to the people that, hey, you're cutting into our profits, and we're going to sue you if you cut into our profits. So that's terrible. That's very undemocratic, and somehow puts a artificial legal entity of a corporation more important than a sovereign nation. So that screwed up the balance of power. Rollbacks of food safety, health, and environmental protections came with NAFTA. So just to make the American corporations more competitive, they didn't have to follow those darn and annoying food safety, health, and environmental protections. Like, for God's sakes, people, like that, like, this is what NAFTA is all about. It's just putting more money in corporations' pockets. So the consequences of this were, there was an uprising in Mexico immediately after, because what happened was the subsistence corn farmers and peasants of Mexico, once the tariffs were gone, they were going to be, their market was going to be flooded with American corn that was grown for super cheap, and their lives would be destroyed. So they tried to revolt. They were unfortunately unsuccessful, but their struggle is seen and I think should be admired for standing up to an international cabal, a continent-wide wide screwing over of these people, and they fought back. Although they did use force, it was necessary, in my opinion, as they were being decimated economically. So more power to those people. Anyway, so I think that's pretty much covers NAFTA and why the objections to it were there in the first place. So NAFTA, in general, good for great for corporations, huge payday for corporations, terrible for workers, absolutely terrible. So we now turn to our great foreign minister, Chrystia Freeland. This is a CBC article. It was written by Peter Siminojic and Rosemary Barton. This was posted October 1st. And the title is, Freeland says landing in a renegotiated NAFTA deal was always going to come down to the wire. In the article, it has some very interesting quotes from Chrystia Freeland that I want to share with all of you. The article reads, Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland said that if there was ever going to be possible to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement, she believed a deal would only happen at the last possible moment. She says, we had a bit of, we didn't actually bet on this, but there was a conversation inside the team of when in September it would happen, and I think it's fair for me now to reveal I've always thought it would happen on a Sunday night, Freeland told CBC's The National. I always thought it wouldn't be finally finalized until the 11th hour. Freeland said that despite the challenge ahead of her and the expected drama to come, that NAFTA, now renamed the USMCA, was a trading relationship that worked, was beneficial to all three partners, and that economic logic ultimately does prevail. So I was really, really ultimately in my heart serene about the outcome, she said. So, if we kind of covered in the last segment how the Liberal government doesn't give a crap about people suffering on the streets from addiction, people suffering because they can't get legal heroin that isn't contaminated with fentanyl. Now, she's basically spitting in the face of the workers, Chrystia Freeland is, and that's just another part of the Liberal Party that's super disgusting and I find abhorrent, and I certainly will never be pledging my vote to the Federal Liberal Party, and I hope none of you do either. And it just really shows in her words who her true constituency is. And we've covered this in the past, especially with the whole Kinder Morgan big mess that became. And it just shows you how they're only concerned with enriching corporations even further. So it was great for all three countries. Well, who do you mean in those three countries, Chrystia? Clearly you mean the corporations of those three countries, and that's the only people it could possibly have benefited. It's not like life has gotten exceptionally better since 1994. It's not like we're all living in like mansions or something and like this was the greatest trade deal ever. Well, it was great for the people that it was meant to serve, which is like the corporate cabal, the corporate elite at the top of our society. They cashed out big time because now they don't have to pay their workers anything in Mexico or move their move any jobs wherever they want to now with the whole like world free trade thing that's going on. And globalization was supposed to bring democracy to these places, but you know what it brought instead? Democracy is just code for business. They think that if it's a free market society, which a free market, well, if you've all played Monopoly and you're betting on different property, you know who's going to get that property? The person with the most money, because that's how free market capitalism works. If you have the most money, it goes to the highest bidder. So guess what? The highest bidders of our society dominated NAFTA. They love NAFTA. That's why they had to do it behind closed doors, because for the most of us, because we work for our paychecks, and not just collect dividends on our stock portfolios, we need to subsidize their laziness and just their inability to understand how people need a livelihood. And while everybody, I'm sure that's a worker, agrees, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. We love all that jazz. But guess what? That's not the way it works. That's not their goal. It's not their class aim. They want to enrich themselves. They don't care about us. And if they have to screw us over to enrich themselves, they will. And that's what they did. And even after almost 30 years, like 24 years of NAFTA, like, it was never enough. It's not like if things have gotten better. Things have gotten worse. It was a rallying cry for Trump. So you know people are hurting. That's why they voted for him, because he was so strong on NAFTA. Like, it really hits people, working class people that lost their jobs over these things. And they can see how corporations and the elite are just getting richer and richer and richer, and they're just laughing and spitting in their face. And that's exactly what Chrystia Freeland did there. She said it benefited all three parties. Well, no, it didn't. It didn't benefit the workers of any of those countries. Clearly, the Mexican workers, peasants, were so upset that they took up arms against their own government. And for that reason, I think the Liberal government doesn't even care if they get reelected. It just seems that they're just there to either just take the crap from the right and just be like called out for being soft, whatever that means, and at the same time pander to the left to the best of their abilities, which they're not very good at, because when push comes to shove, they have to sell out like leftist ideas, but they still do their best nonetheless to pretend like they care about workers, to pretend like they care about the environment, to even pretend like they care about poor people and people with substance use disorder. So that's my little tidbit of why I hate the Liberal government so much, and why I'm praying, not praying, but trying to build a socialist world where we're not suffering under these horrible conditions set by people who don't even give a crap about us. So please wish me good luck in that endeavor. So we're gonna have to take a short break for commercials, but we'll be right back to discuss NAFTA and the USMCA and what it means for us today. So we'll be back in just 1 second.
People are really done with politics as usual.
But then it's all about the competition.
Every Vancouverite has their own story.
The perfect time for our alternative.
Vancouver's municipal election looms. October 20th. Do you know who's running for
City Council? School Board? Parks Board?
This is a wacky municipal election, and you're going to want to stay updated. Download Seeking Office. The newest municipal elections podcast from CITR's News Collective. Find Seeking Office on iTunes and Stitcher, or wherever you download your podcasts, starting July 3rd.
What newspapers and magazines did you regularly read to stay informed and to understand the
world?
I've
read most of them, again, with a great appreciation for the press, for the media.
But like, what ones specifically?
All of them.
Want to know more than Sarah Palin? Join CITR's Current Affairs Coordinator Alex DeBoer every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. in room 2514 in the AMS Nest to learn best practices for covering local current affairs topics for radio. The weekly training sessions will cover writing for radio, determining newsworthiness, media ethics, interviewing, writing balanced stories, and more.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Lachey Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm your host, Spencer Latu, and we're talking NAFTA, and we're talking the USMCA. It's not so fun to say it the YMCA. The USMCA, that is. So, this has been regarded generally, I'll say, it's a different NAFTA, as the CBC concedes, but it doesn't really say much about they're mainly focusing on dairy and cars, which I will not focus on because I view it as very inconsequential. They're basically it. Well, I will say one thing about dairy. Okay, you got me, guys. You're twisting my arm here. So dairy, the only reason why United States dairy farmers even want a part of the Canadian market is just so they can expand. It's just the natural tendency of capital, and under capitalism, is to expand. It's infinite growth in a finite system. We're a finite world. The U.S. Dairy market isn't big enough for them, so they want to move into Canada's. Very simple. It's not very... I just don't really see... how one could miss that. There's a lot of saying how they want to share and they care and all this other crap, and it's all just platitudes. They just want to sell more dairy to more people. And as someone who's going dairy free just because I got really sick after having too much whey protein powder, I could care less about the dairy market. So that's my take on it, but that's one thing I'll say about it. So moving on. Luckily, we have Michael Geist, somebody who cares about reading the fine print, as he says on his website. He's got a great blog, michaelgeist.ca. This blog post by Michael Geist, From Copyright Term to Super Bowl Commercials, Breaking Down the Digital NAFTA Deal. So there's only been a day to really digest what's going on here, so I don't really have the authority to speak on much other than one interesting pharmaceutical aspect of the deal, of the USMCA, the biologics issue. So what are biologics? Well, biologics are biologically based pharmaceutical drugs. They require some form of living organism to take part of it to create the drug, and hence the name biologics. Pretty uncreative right there, but that's just how it is. Now, what's the issue around them? Well, you know, if you're using living things, it probably costs some money. And guess what? You're right. They are very expensive. So what Michael Geist has to say about biologics and how they fit into the USMCA is this. On the patent side, the big change is the extension of data protection for biologics drugs to 10 years. This is a significant increase on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which offered 8 years or 5 years plus other measures to provide a comparable outcome in the market. This was one of the most contentious Trans-Pacific Partnership issues, as countries recognize that every additional year potentially adds billions of healthcare costs. In fact, even United States agencies have expressed doubt about the need for long-term protections. Coming on the heels of the Canada-EU trade deal, which effectively extended patent terms, the additional cost for pharmaceuticals in Canada in the long term will be enormous. You hear that, folks? Enormous. And that's important to point out, because that is one thing you can expect to hear in the mainstream media. And just if you think I'm full of it and I'm just making crazy conspiratorial claims, well, just watch the news and see how much they're going to be talking about issues that really affect people, such as drug prices. Biologics are already expensive. I saw a tweet by some guy that claimed that it was one dose a month and it costs $1,800. So for 10 years, you're locking in that anecdote of $1,800 a month. Let's just say that's the case. And of course, by owning the patent, if they ever want to renew it or do something else with it, they can just jack up the price even more. So once again, taking this from a materialist perspective, the capitalist class that owns the intellectual property of the biologics drugs that they're selling to people, and big pharma and the like, they can now have free rein to charge whatever they want for these things for the next 10 years. So that I view as very troubling and just very against the ideas and ideals expressed with these free trade deals, is that they're supposed to open up the world and give people more freedom and globalize and, you know, just make the world a big, happy community. But let's just say it for what it really is. It's just a cash grab in the dying days of capitalism. There's no way they can keep going charging people exorbitant amounts of money, just absolutely insane amounts of money, for the drugs that make them live. If it hasn't been apparent to more and more people that their indentured servants that work are just merely cogs in the machine of corporations and the corporate world, like the $1,800 a month to live price tag probably should wake you up. The fact that we're not subsidizing the cost of living, the literal cost it takes for a human being to exist from day to day, while we spend billions and billions and billions and billions and even trillions of dollars on war. For example, $1 trillion has been spent on the war on drugs in America. Can you believe that, folks? $1 trillion fighting a war that is lost. Drug use is rampant. The opioid crisis has killed like a Vietnam's worth of people annually in the United States. It's about to kill 1,400 people in British Columbia. So it's not working. But guess what? They'll throw our precious resources at it. And that's where I come in and I say that this is just silly. There's no moral justification. There's no even economic justification for this. We're 10 years out of Lehman Brothers crashing. Okay, that was last Tuesday or so, and it's still on my mind because it's been a decade since the people who pretended like they knew what was going on, the people that made millions of dollars and sneered at the rest of us because they were the keepers of the market, they were like the clergy of the of capitalism, that they knew exactly what to do with your money and the world's money, and they knew what was best for everybody, and at the whole time they were grifters that ended up crashing the whole system and killing people and throwing people out of their homes and basically paving the way for Donald Trump today. And from that, I'm going to draw a straight line through the war on drugs, a needless, baseless political ploy by the liberals, into their political ploy of NAFTA to please their true constituency, the bourgeoisie, the people who own the means of production in Canada. So basically the CEOs, the shareholders, the boards of directors, the political class that makes money for off of all this stuff that's going on. Those are the people that are winning. NAFTA, or the USMCA, I should call it now, is not going to do anything for workers. In fact, it's going to make everyone's life worse. It's going to just as it did in 1994, it's going to make workers even more powerless to stop a system that's killing them. If all they can say is a success is locking in drug prices so that regular working class people need to spend even more of their hard-earned money just to live and work another day, you can't say that this system is worth saving. It's just absurd. It's silly to make people run on this hamster wheel of life and expect them to go in there with a smile and be proud of their country and all the other crap they tell you to be proud of and be happy about, when the people that are in the institution that's for the people, by the people, the government, are actively screwing them. The people that we all voted in, I personally voted NDP, but the liberals that are supposed to represent the entire country represent only the smallest minority of Canadians that are wealthy enough to benefit from this trade deal. And guess what? That's all they care about, and that's all they need to do to get elected in this country. And I hope people realize, as we're going to be creeping up on BC referendum, and you can see the powerful getting their knickers in a twist over that, it's not really one man, one vote, people. It's $1, one vote. The plutocrats call the shots. The plutocrats get what they want. The plutocrats decided, hey, we need NAFTA to go our way. The USMCA to go our way. So Trudeau, go win some political points with Trump. So just throw those silly people on the streets who are, how they are stuck living on the downtown east side, just fending for their lives. We'll just throw them under the bus so I can make even more dollars. I'm just going to kick to the curb the people who are already suffering the most in our society just so I can make an extra buck. And that's what the endless pursuit of profit looks like. Whether or not we all want to admit it, but that's what it takes, is that we either need to have a tide that lifts all the boats, or we can just push their boats down even more. And that's what we're opting to do instead in this very late stage of capitalism, that we're just pushing and agitating these people more and more and more. And, I don't know, I can see it for what it is, and I hope everyone else can see it for what it is, but it seems like they're not, because it's just going to wait until it comes at our door that, we're going to have to give up even more to just exist. And I don't believe in that. The Back to the Future 2 projected a far better life than we have right now, and I was kind of looking forward to that, watching that movie as a kid, thinking that, oh well, things have gotten better over time, so things will continue to get better. Well, it can't under capitalism, because what capitalism requires is capital to keep gaining and gaining and gaining at the expense of labor. And guess who labor is? That's us. That's people who work. Okay, we're not sitting around just owning private property or intellectual property and collecting our paychecks and sitting on boards of directors and giving $100,000 talks like Hillary Clinton is, and all these other people that just laugh in our faces and spit in our faces every single day when they go on and say, oh, this is great for everybody. It's not great for everybody. It's really not. And I'll tell you who it's not good for. It's not good for us. The majority of people who work, and the majority of people who are suffering right now, the majority of people who are barely making ends meet, that's not, you're not serving us. And we still have a vote, but it doesn't matter. And that's where, you know, it's hard not to get disillusioned. It's hard not to get cynical. And I made it a promise to end these shows not on these dark, pessimistic notes about how everyone's trying to screw us. So here's some ideas that I've been concocting. Well, number one, what we need to do is need to get off screens and start talking face-to-face with regular people. Because guess what, everybody? Regular people banding together and serving each other and serving their community's needs is what's going to get us out of this mess, okay? Because the longer we rely on the bourgeoisie, and even to some extent, the state, to help us and protect us from the pending climate disaster, or even the pending, hopefully not anytime soon, and I don't want this for the record, but you can start seeing it.